Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer, and also you got my co-host, Dr. Carl, super endocrinologist, and we got back our awesome guest, Dr. Lauren Semple. She's an expert in women's physiology, all things muscle building, nutrition, and everything similar to that. We're bringing her back to dispel some myths that we keep seeing online by a few gurus that we see kind of promoting some of this nonsense. And I've been loving her Instagram posts recently, kind of dispelling some of these myths. So make sure you follow her, Dr. Lauren Semple. Makes some really good infographics, but we're going to go over some of these in rapid fire. So welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Happy to be back.
Yeah. All right. We're going to pick the top, I'd say, five. And if we have more time, we'll go over more, I suppose. What's the most common myth that is in the women's health space, the women's fitness space right now? Number one.
It's hard to pick one.
All right, pick one. We'll go to the next one.
Well, so, I mean, and I got started on this little path several weeks ago because of the current sort of like big thing is the whole morning fasting exercise. Don't do it because that's when your cortisol's the highest and it somehow has detrimental effects in that regard. So she and I did a little endocrine women's physiology perspective debunk 1 minute job. And that's kind of what led to, okay, we got to do a whole podcast on this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, I think there's a lot of, demonizing cortisol and therefore fasting. And the message is that specifically for women, they need to focus on pre and post workout nutrition and really make sure they're getting protein pre and post right before your workout, right after your workout, or you will gain body fat and lose muscle and wreak havoc on your hormones.
Yeah, that's some strong fear mongering out there. So, okay. So I thought this myth got busted a decade ago.
But you know what's funny is that when this was coming up, I was kind of going, wow, it seems like about 10 years ago, Brad Schoenfeld and Alan Aragon, they were doing a lot of the research or at least reviewing the research on fasted cardio and exercise because people used to think that that must have been better. And that certainly sounds biologically plausible, right? I mean, and there's, there are some things to it for people with like, say, type 2 diabetes and whatnot, but that's the nuance, the forest and the trees, all that stuff. And they debunked that. So now suddenly it went the opposite direction.
Yeah, exactly. It used to be, if acutely we're burning more fat, we're oxidizing more fat as fuel, then does that mean it would affect long-term body fat loss? And so then all the bodybuilders started doing fasted cardio. And so again, as you said, that was in a long-term study sort of debunked and said, hey, you know what? Fasted state, fed state training, body fat loss is the same. And so I'm not really sure how we went the other direction and said that fasting is now going to increase fat and decrease lean mass.
I have an idea how.
Well, social media is really interesting. I mean, so you get these gurus that just make very strong claims. And
they make money doing it. That's the thing.
They have charisma, though. They have to have a message and get to people. We talk about this all the time about just these, they're just terrible. I think they're just deplorable, terrible humans that do this. And I don't know, they lack ethics, standards and ethics. But that's why, so you see these things that were old and now they're new again. And it's because of these gurus that just seem to not have any scruples. Okay.
And I think that targeting women is a newer thing. Because misinformation in fitness has been around for a long time, but now there's a real specific angle that you are a woman and therefore everything we thought we knew about training and nutrition doesn't apply to you and you need a whole different set of guidelines.
Yeah, the whole women are not tiny men is kind of the the saying that I hear, the little slogan, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And we already know, we know that. And I do want to point out that women got ignored with the whole, we did a whole podcast on menopause and how we went too far away from menopausal hormonal therapy. But now it seems that the it's swinging back the other way, where it's like everybody needs to be on this. And you've been debunking some of these things about hormone replacement therapy. Maybe we can just go jump into some of that.
Yeah, there is a lot of messaging that that either supplements or hormone therapy are kind of the cure-all if you are somebody who is entering or the menopause transition, and that bone density, muscle health, fat loss, that hormone therapy is a cure, that creatine is a cure, that magnesium is a cure. And that really takes away from the focus on diet and exercise, which, as you guys know, is should be kind of the bread and butter of what we're focusing on for these types of adaptations. And what we're seeing is this focus on these other things. And really, hormone therapy works really well for some people for menopause-related symptoms. It's really not approved for those other use cases. There definitely will be more data that comes out in the future, but the idea that every woman should be taking supplements and be on some estrogen-based therapy or low-dose testosterone therapy to preserve muscle and bone health is just not supported by the data in humans.
Yeah, there's some doctors out there pushing this.
But how are those people going to sell their supplements if they don't make up these bullshit claims? And also, you know, with the whole menopausal hormone therapy, I mean, some of that's been very specifically debunked. I mean, we do have a ton of data on menopausal hormone therapy going way back to the Women's Health Initiative, which initially scared people away and then got, you know, it's cut up a little bit and looked at a little bit deeper before more studies came out and, you know, all the timing stuff. I mean, we know for sure it is good for bones. It still doesn't mean everybody needs it. We know if you start earlier than later, there is a trend toward a suggested possible, you know, metabolic heart benefit, but not so substantially that it's recommended.
We can't make the claim.
Risk reduction that the people out there are trying to claim. And certainly if people have any symptoms, yeah, they feel better. But there are still reasons that, you know, people don't need to be on it. They, you know, whatever. And they just go, they have to be so extreme to everything.
Yeah. Okay. So because here's the claim. I've made a post in the past about, I do this all the time, showing that metabolic rates do not actually start declining until you're 60. And this is data from John Speakman and the doubly labeled water project that they have going on. And so like, and I'm friends with these guys and we chat all the time.
Yeah. That was just recently kind of updated and published in the past couple of years. Ago, yeah. Where it's like 65 and that, wasn't it?
Yeah. So was it 60? It was 60. It was 60. And so then
even then,
you know, a couple of menopause influencers come on and be like, yeah, but through menopause, people start losing their muscle. So then, that has a huge effect on metabolic rate. So this isn't true. And I'm like, no, the doubly labeled water doesn't lie. So tell us a little bit about muscle and the change through menopause and hormonal therapy.
Yeah, I think taking the metabolic rate in and of itself is also probably a mistake, because we need to look at that and then use that as a hypothesis to generate longer term data. So if we're looking at muscle, if we're looking at fat, then sometimes it's just like we were talking about with cortisol, right? The acute measure doesn't necessarily pan out long term. But what we see with the menopause transition specifically is there's nothing there to suggest it is going to accelerate age-related muscle loss. We know that muscle declines with age, but it declines in men, it declines in women. And there are longer-term data sets measuring women through the transition. And there's nothing about, oh, you were perimenopause and now you're postmenopause, and during that window you lost a substantial amount of muscle. It's really related to age and then attenuated by resistance training.
So we go back to resistance training.
Yep. Hence the name of the podcast, and we're shills for strength training. Oh, but you know, the problem is that strength training actually does acutely increase cortisol. So
yeah, so you shouldn't do it. Whatever. Shouldn't do it,
even though it's so, proven to be beneficial. That's fine.
Here's another claim. There's some people in the menopause community saying you need to focus on protein first, then resistance training. And as somebody who trained with Dr. Stu Phillips, and who we are friends with, and we are shills for resistance training and protein. But my understanding, based on the literature, is that resistance training is magnitudes higher of priority and importance than protein. What do you say?
Yeah, I think exactly what you alluded to, that people are starting to put protein and even creatine supplementation on the same level of benefit as resistance training, when really resistance training is the cake and then the protein is the icing on the cake. So, you know, you need to, if you're not resistance training, eating a ton of protein is not building muscle for you. And same goes for creatine. So this hyper focus on protein, not to say protein isn't important, it is, but in the absence of resistance training, it's not going to give you these meaningful, substantial benefits.
Yeah. What, and tell us about creatine.
I think with supplements in general, most of them do pretty much nothing in the exercise space. So the fact that creatine might do a little something gives it this huge spotlight, because if we're just talking supplements, the fact that there is one out there in fitness that does anything at all, people really like to magnify that. But in reality, yes, if you are resistance training, if you are doing some high intensity training, it can give you a small boost in performance. It can also increase measures of lean mass because of the intracellular water retention in the muscle cell itself. But in terms of it being a substitute for resistance training, absolutely not. The data on benefits for bone health are really underwhelming. I would not take it for bone. And the whole pitch that it's sort of a must-take supplement for postmenopausal women just really is overhyped.
Yeah, I saw Dr. Claire Haver, who we, you know,
does she sell her own creatine? Of course.
She does. And it's three times the price as getting your creatine monohydrate at the, you know, GNC or Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about it is, you know, so the thing with creatine is, yes, it has these hints of benefit, you know, especially in athletes, high-level training, stuff like that. And it's been proven to be so safe. And then there are these studies that say, oh, it has a little bit of benefit for, say, our patients with type 2 diabetes. Oh, maybe it has some favorable suggestions in osteoporosis. But I'll tell you, I did a little lit review for you, you know, with the osteoporosis is in my world. And there are some like markers, hints, but like you said, it's not like the medicines we have by any means. It doesn't actually reverse anything. And maybe it's, you know, if my patients with osteoporosis are lifting weights that hard, that they're getting benefits from creatine, they don't need the creatine for their bones. If they want to take it, that's fine. So that's the thing. I think when it's so safe and it's easily sold, and then, you know, then there's even like, you know, potential cognitive hints of benefit. So then they call it a panacea for everything and then they sell it.
Truly a cherry on top. Like you said, like for my whenever my patients ask me, should I take creatine? I'm like, well, are you lifting weights? Because if you're not lifting weights, I don't really care if you take it. And yeah, so when they are lifting weights, they want to see if they can improve their performance. I'm like, sure. Cherry on top, creatine. And maybe that's the benefit for osteoporosis if they're doing the resistance training and it allows them to do an extra few reps and sets. I don't know.
I mean, the bone stuff was actually really promising in the preclinical, you know, rodent models, but it just doesn't seem to pan out. There was a big trial, a 2-year trial in women over 60 taking creatine. I don't think the data is there to recommend it for bone. And the big problem is that there is this overemphasis on this that seems to allow people to think, hey, I can just take the supplement and I'm good.
Was it plus resistance training with the creatine, or just creatine plus or against the placebo?
In that, it was creatine plus resistance training. And they showed an effect of not bone density, but like geometric modeling.
Trabecular bone score
like,
or something?
I don't know that's meaningfully relevant, but no. you give me your perspective.
Well, and, I mean, and this gets into, you know, the osteoporosis world. And the reason some drugs get approved for osteoporosis is not just because of bone density improvement. So we can make bone density look better through a variety of different ways. And that doesn't necessarily correlate to what we actually care about. And that's reducing the risk of fractures. So even, you know, even resistance training by itself doesn't always improve bone density per se, but it does improve bone quality and reduce fracture risk through a whole bunch of different methods. So one is the bone quality and actual fracture risk reduction, but also, like I tell all my patients, no matter what medicine we use that actually does do these things, if you don't fall, you're not going to break a hip. And so strength training, balance training, fall prevention are also very important for, you know, especially the people I'm seeing in endocrine with the elderly people with really, you know, severe osteoporosis, et cetera. And so, you know, yeah, the creatine is just not going to cut it at all.
Yep. All right. What's the next myth? Let's bust another thing.
One thing that's out there while we're talking peri-post menopause is that everyone needs to lift heavy weights and do sprint interval training. So there's a lot of fear-based messaging saying, you know, that lower intensity cardio is going to destroy your bones. It's going to increase your visceral fat, and that basically doing sets of 10, 12, 15 are a waste of time because they are no longer an impetus to build lean mass. You know, we really need under 5 rep type training.
Dear Lord. What's ironic about that is that's quite the opposite of some other scaremongering extremist gurus who claim that high intensity exercise increases cortisol too much and females shouldn't do it. Jeez.
What do you do? Apparently all exercise is bad.
Right. And yet, the ironic thing about it is, what is the actual conclusion about the different reps, ranges, volume, et cetera, for muscle hypertrophy and all, you know, those types of benefits from it?
We have so much data on this at this point in older men, older women, younger men, younger women. As long as you are training with a sufficient stimulus, meaning you're going close enough to failure, it really doesn't matter what rep range you are training in. You can do sets of 5, you can do sets of 30. It really doesn't matter. So you should do it based on preference. And when it comes to the sprint interval training versus the lower intensity stuff, again, if the goal is lean mass, we're focusing on the wrong thing here, resistance train. If the goal is fat loss, frankly, we're probably still focusing on the wrong thing and we need to look at diet. But both can be effective for changes in moderate changes in body composition over time. And I think the fact that there's any sort of don't do this for any physical activity for older people is just asinine. If there's something you enjoy and you will be able to sustain over time, this is a good thing and we should be promoting it.
Perfectly. And the key is really, you know, literally we always say it's what's on the inside that counts. And so, you know, doing some resistance training is just good for you. And from a metabolic health perspective, technically doing a little bit higher volume and not just like really low weight really high weight, low reps, where you're not getting actually a lot of true exercise out of it, that's not as metabolically healthy for, you know, it's, again, like a lot of our real patients who need it.
Weighted vests. What's the deal?
Big trend. You mentioned your friend, Dr. Haver. She also sells weighted vests, if we can.
Really? What's the
point?
It's just, I mean, I don't mind weighted vests, but tell us this, tell us the gist.
Okay. So
you're more up on that.
The trend or the message being promoted is that walking with a weighted vest is going to be meaningful for improving muscle and bone. And when we actually look at the literature, there's some weighted vest training, but typically it's not walking. It's resistance training using weighted vests as the resistance. I don't have a problem with that. I think it's not ideal for all exercises, but let's say you're somebody with some grip issues and maybe you want to do lunges or squats with a weighted vest, I think that's fine. But the idea that walking with a weighted vest that's, you know, 5-10 pounds is going to make meaningful improvements when it comes to muscle and bone, I think is way too much of an overstatement. And the doses that people are kind of prescribing for this is 3 times a week, go for a 20-minute walk with a weighted vest.
I mean,
I don't think we're going to see much.
You'd have to have a consistent load for long periods of time to probably make a difference, right?
I mean, the thing is, it does sound reasonable, right? I mean, I don't know that why you would need
bone,
to buy any specific
femur.
Thing. I mean, yeah, if you're carrying weight, you know, yeah, you're. I mean, that makes some sense, and there certainly doesn't. You know, I don't think there's anything wrong with it per se. It just the fact that they take it to such an extreme and say, "Oh, everyone has to do this." Oh, by the way, I sell one, which it's okay. Not that they're not allowed to sell it. It's just the way they market it is bullshit.
But it's just overhyped to say if you go for a walk wearing a weighted vest, you're going to build muscle. No, you're not. At least not meaningfully long term. Maybe if you have never exercised in your life and you start going for a walk, yeah, you'll build a tiny bit of muscle in the beginning. That's true. Novice trainees kind of build a little bit of muscle from everything, incline walking, cycling. But should we be telling people this is what, of all the things, this is what you need to do for muscle?
Right.
No. Or bone for that matter.
I'm trying to go to your Instagram because there are some other things that I posted recently. Oh, just like the women aren't supposed to train aren't tiny men. So go over this because this was a good one.
Yeah, what is that? What are they getting at?
They're getting at
we are
women
different.
Need to train differently than men.
Right.
That's.
But what? Yeah.
Let's hear it.
So. I mean, I think all these claims that we've been getting at, you know, the fasted training, the needing to eat immediately post-workout, the needing to lift in a different rep range. There's claims that you should have different rest periods between sets, that everything changes through the menopause transition. So basically the theme here is that what we know about muscle, fat loss, and overall health in men does not apply to women. And the kind of key or hook that people use is, you know, there's not anywhere near enough evidence in women. And so, you know, we must be a different species, essentially.
That is the claim.
and really, we actually do have quite a bit of research in women. It's true that there are areas where, you know, female participants are underrepresented. I know we talked about this last time with all the menstrual cycle stuff, and that's one of the barriers that why people hesitate to study women as opposed to men, because they're concerned about the influence of the menstrual cycle on various outcome measures. But really, when we look at the outcomes we care about when it comes to muscle, fat loss, it doesn't seem to differ. The same basic principles apply regardless of your sex or age.
So it turns out these gurus don't have a secret. And they're not doing the research anyway.
Right. Of course, they're not the ones doing the research or publishing the research.
Just making
they're just
up
trying
stuff.
They're trying to exploit the research to sell for their own benefit. And, you know, I had this conversation with a patient the other day, and I know we all probably always say this because he was like, I think I was actually literally talking about this stuff, how Lauren and I had to debunk, you know, the people who were saying, oh, fasted training in the morning when your cortisol is high is going to cause all sorts of problems. And we went through all the literature and through tons of studies and meta-analyses and extrapolating different things like fasted exercise just in general. It all is fine. It's not beneficial per se, but it's not detrimental. You know, he said, well, so when is the best time to exercise? And I said, the obvious answer, well, the best time to exercise is whenever you're actually going to make it happen in reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, oh my God, yes. And it's like, that's so simple to us. But whenever people can find the time and know that it's going to be able to become a habit is the best time for that person, because otherwise it just doesn't matter. And yes, I'm going to play that again at the end of the podcast.
It just doesn't matter. Just doesn't matter.
Lauren's the hell are you guys talking about? But Dad will know. He'll love it.
Complexity sells. That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, you make it seem complicated, if I tell you you have a problem and I have a solution and here's why you can't figure it out by yourself, I've sold you something. And that's what's going on.
Yeah. And yet in the realm of, you know, my favorite quote from one of my preceptors in endocrinology fellowship, who's actually the dean of students at the Uniformed Health Services Medical School, he says, and I tell everybody, you embrace the complexity. So a lot of this stuff is complex when you dig into the weeds, especially endocrinology and all that stuff. But we can still act with simplicity for patients. But yet the people selling the stuff, they know they sell it more by baffling with bullshit, Spencer's favorite term for Huberman, rather than giving them the simple, just acting with simplicity, which most of my patients actually want, I think, in reality. Don't you think, Spencer?
Yeah, no, that's right.
And I think if you use really complex, sciencey sounding words to sell your message, mm-hmm. then people just take your word for it, regardless of whether the conclusion actually was supported by what you just said.
Yeah. I mean, that's why, I mean, this is what we push and you push. I love your Instagram. You're growing quickly. Everybody
yes, we
should
love
follow.
You.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We love you, Dr. Lauren.
We really do. We do. We love you so much.
Superstar. No, cause it's very simple. It's just like, you know, you don't have anything to sell. I think you're doing like a research review with, Dr. Eric Trexler or something like that, Front Page Fitness, or is that a podcast? What is that?
That's a podcast. But the Mass Research Review is the one thing that I, you know, quote unquote, sell. It's a super deep dive, unbiased research review.
You're selling science. You're selling
so,
research.
Like, yeah. It's information. It's not a product. So I don't have an angle, right?
Yeah. I mean,
well,
like
same
the
with
thing
us
is,
if we can ever get anybody to pay us for the podcast.
Well, no.
Come on, Mr. Peanut.
I'm going to sponsor the podcast myself with Vineyard because it's growing quickly. And what I sell is basically a service. Like it's just standard stuff, like good stuff, but not making it seem like it's anything special. It's just good, like standard, whatever. It's like a lifting program. There's other good people out there selling just evidence-based, science-based lifting programs that are tailored to you. Like that's a good, that's a good,
too boring, not good. Sexy, not lucrative.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, the message is so boring. And so people mm-hmm. say, oh, you should write a book. And I'm like, no one would buy it because.
That's what we say all the time.
It's actually a true story. I've gone to many of these book agents and they always say, but what's your angle? I'm like, what do you mean? What is my angle? The angle is there is no angle. And then I'm going to tell you exactly what you need to know, and it's the basics. They're like, yeah, but that won't sell. Like they're like, well, what about like think about like Wheat Belly, you know, that guy back over a decade ago.
Yeah,
I'm like, yeah, that's nonsense though. They're like, yeah, but it sells. I'm like, oh my god, I can't do this.
It's so bad. That's why
that's the problem with so many of these really popular podcasts, because they're basically designed for these viral clips that say, you know, if you eat Brussels sprouts, then it will activate your brown fat to burn your jiggly mm-hmm. fat, and that's how fat loss.
Did you send that to me?
I just
somebody sent that to me.
I saw that yesterday.
Oh my god! you know what? You just made me realize that kind of the OG before all the social media podcast stuff was Dr. Oz. You know,
100%.
So he's a real legitimate good surgeon. Gets onto Oprah, tries to have a medical show. Turns out it's boring. So then suddenly has all these bullshit supplements and becomes a grifter. And it's not like he's selling the stuff. He's selling the bullshit for the other stuff.
Yeah.
And like now that's what all these podcasters are doing. They don't necessarily sell other things. I mean, I don't know. I know. I mean, because Huberman, like, you know, he just has all the bullshit sponsors podcast, right?
Yeah.
It's
but
not
I mean,
like
that's very lucrative. Those sponsorships are extremely lucrative.
And that's why we don't make any money, because we don't endorse their bullshit. Damn it.
So I need to read you a quote from that same podcast with a different guest, but same host.
Oh, boy.
So this doctor said, abs are built in the kitchen, works for men. It doesn't work for women. Men can take out whiskey and chocolate and get super ripped, but when a woman takes it out, there's no change because the hypothalamus is like, where are those calories I need? If we want to eat a little bit cleaner, we have to make sure we are providing enough calories. If we have enough calories to overcome the stress and fuel the training, you're going to get those abs.
Oh, my God.
I think I know who you're talking
Spencer
about.
Spencer would say abs are made in the womb when he's referring to me. But
abs are made in utero.
And, you know, I mean, talk about something that is a, you know, embracing the complexity but acting with simplicity. You know, nutrition Well, who was the old, well, nutrition we know is the king for this stuff. And then the exercise, who said that? What did he say? The opposite, the old guy, the old exercise guy. Oh, well, whatever.
Jack LaLanne.
Yeah. Jack LaLanne. Anyways. But it's such a, you know, a basic combination of those things that's important. And again, more so for health rather than having abs. But as we know, athletes, young athletes who have abs all the time, it's a very good combination of quality nutrition along with their exercise. And so, what she's, or is it a female that said that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know who it is.
I'm sure I do.
It's another endocrinologist.
Oh, no.
I believe, right? She was on. Was this the same podcast? Am I correct on that?
No, this is our other friend with a PhD who's, you know, women are not
was
small
on,
men.
Was that, oh, that's the same person there?
Sims.
On the Mel Robbins one.
Okay. Oh, so you're saying but a different, was, yeah, because one of our, we have a, yeah, anyways. But I guess the pathophysiology is just completely wrong, what she just said. I mean, that's not true. We have lots of data on that in females, mind you, mostly.
Well, I mean, what I'm reading there is, you know, if a man creates a deficit by taking out the alcohol and the chocolate, mm-hmm. then he will build, his abs will become visible, which is a fair thing to say, mm-hmm. but that if a woman does that, then she won't, because she is a woman. And so she needs to replace those calories from the alcohol and the chocolate with something else because of the hypothalamus. Right.
Blatantly false with a huge body of evidence. And females actually do get more research in this area these days, in obesity especially. But even just pure anecdotes, and you're in the world of fitness science, right? So whenever we see females with abs, they're always, you know, athletes and like bodybuilders or fitness participants. And it's always through their nutrition, doing it really in the same way that is prescribed to males, just with different, you know, body types and, you know, caloric prescriptions and stuff lower.
But unless you're genetically elite and somehow are one of those people with naturally super low body fat and your abs show all the time, which is rare, and even more rare if you're a woman, nobody ever got visible abs without a calorie deficit. That's just the reality.
That's why Spencer says abs are made in the womb for some people. Anyways.
Gosh, that's really,
it still takes quality diet and exercise. You know,
Mel Robbins' podcast is huge too. It's just too bad that there's
like I said, I know a guy who went to school with her but you know, she had to get whatever. It's unfortunate.
I don't know.
And she doesn't know. She's not a scientist at all. She's just a podcast popular person. So it's not like she knows. I don't give her a pass.
That somebody with a podcast that size has a big team of people. If you have a podcast that's going to reach millions of people, you have a responsibility to get your team to vet these guests. You're promoting them, you're platforming them. That's on you. And true. It's so clear that this is, they're trying to kind of pull this crazy, like, I didn't know that you were doing everything wrong. You know, this superfood, this magic program, that's the angle. She has to know that.
Well, let's get you on
there. So it's the same blueprint as the other crazies.
Let's get Lauren on there. Let's get Dr. Lauren on there.
Please. For the love of God.
They would
have me on. Come on, Mel.
But I think it's really kind of more focused on females, though, isn't it?
I don't know. They just had a guy on there that was just making up stuff. That was some quack doctor.
And it's always the quacks because the real stuff is boring and doesn't get traction.
Because anyone who is reasonable and educated and isn't trying to sell some insane bullshit would say, yeah, you know what? It's exercise and it's diet and it's consistency and long-term adherence and behavior change, and everyone's falling asleep. So what you want to hear is like, broccoli is terrible for you.
Yeah, that's what they want to hear.
God, don't exercise in the morning. It's when your cortisol is the highest and cortisol is catabolic. Oh, exercise in the morning because we are fasting. Oh, just
God. You'll get a sponsor if we just start saying crazy shit and clip it.
Yeah. Geez, so right. So in reality, wait. So does it matter?
It just doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. I tell you, it just doesn't matter.
Thorne doesn't even know where this is from, does he?
It just doesn't matter.
We're playing this for my dad because he loves It Just Doesn't Matter scene from Meatballs.
It's usually after we lost a wrestling match and we were all upset. And he's like, it doesn't matter.
I'm
like,
it just doesn't matter.
It just doesn't matter.
That's Bill Murray from Meatballs. Now Lauren has homework. She has to watch it.
Oh, all right. Where can people find you, Dr. Lauren? Well, this has been rich, full of information. I'm going to actually post it today.
Amazing. Dr. Lauren CS1 on Instagram, and I look forward to being back on again.
I'm sure we're going to have
a couple months.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
yeah. Oh, yes.
You know, I imagine the misinformation isn't going anywhere.
It's not. Apparently.
Thank you. I'll send this to a friend. People. In fact, I got to make sure I post this in my patient group because a lot of these things keep coming up. And they've been loving my Instagram stories because I keep posting you in my stories, like all of the stuff, all the things.
Yeah, let's be clear. They don't love your stories. They love Lauren's.
No, they don't
like.
They like Lauren. They don't like me. All right,
give me some followers.
Yes, I will keep sending them your way. Here is our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.